This is a HeadGum Original.
Okay, so full disclosure, one of the reasons it occurred to me to talk to you for this is because Jimmy Fallon is in episode 5 of Band of Brothers.
Oh, that's the episode you were going to be on?
Yeah, we were going to be in the same episode of TV.
In the same scene?
Not in the same scene.
Okay. Was that early in his, like, I remember?
Alex Songsha is a comedian, writer, actor, and a friend. Someone I've performed with in a lot of different shows and projects over the years. One of my favorite people. I remember the first time I saw her doing comedy in the basement of a bar back in the year 2013. It was an improv show that was happening after midnight on a Tuesday. She had a quiet confidence on stage. Not aggressive, but patient. She would be silent in a scene, sometimes for long periods of time, and then all of a sudden say the perfect funny thing that felt both surprising and inevitable.
But I remember thinking that you were one of the funniest performers I'd ever seen.
Oh, that's so nice.
And I was fascinated because I couldn't figure out what you were doing. Like, sometimes you do improv long enough, you can watch it and you can see the moves. And I couldn't see your moves. Like, you're one of the funniest people. It wasn't a fluke. You're one of the funniest people I've ever met. And
I feel the same about you.
Well, thank you.
I don't know how to. Thank you.
I remember being very excited when I saw that you had been hired by The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Alex started working as a writer on The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon in November of 2016. To me, it seemed like an obviously great pairing, an incredibly funny and talented person, and an iconic late-night TV institution. I sort of filed it away in my brain, like, oh, my friend Alex writes for The Tonight Show now. I think it was actually quite some time before I learned that she didn't work there anymore. She was at The Tonight Show for less than 6 months.
It occurred to me that you are someone who has not been fired by Jimmy Fallon. That makes it sound like you did something wrong. You got called into his office and he said you're fired.
I mean, that's what it felt like at the time.
Not getting a job is one type of rejection that we have to process. But it's a different thing entirely to have to reckon with landing the gig and then it not going the way you thought it would. There's the personal side of it you have to process, but then there's the other part that comes after. How you explain it to everybody else.
The first, 2 months after being released back out into the world, I went on, a slew of general meetings. And I remember every time I was asked about The Tonight Show then, it was very much, kind of glossing over, not getting renewed and being like, oh, and then I left and wanted to pursue, I don't know, acting or whatever else, and just talking about it in the rosiest of ways. And then to, another phase of, being a little more honest about it straight up not liking the experience and expressing that to now maybe a more leveled out
right
retrospect.
When you were working at The Tonight Show, did you ever get comfortable?
No.
Okay. Was it fun?
Times of it were.
The phrasing of that conveys everything.
Well, I guess because it still remains the most recognizable name on my resume, I get asked about it at almost every job interview or general meeting.
Right.
So I've, had practice.
Yeah.
In describing it different ways.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. The reason I was told at the time was that he had seen my audition tape and thought I had dead eyes. And that's the short version.
You just said times of it were. That's your practice.
Yes, I'm very awful in interviews.
That sounds like you've answered it so many times that it's broken you.
Lieutenant, you're a godsend. What's the situation?
I heard you guys are coming in. It was an ammo dump, so... Here, is it just you guys in the 101st?
Looks like. What hit you, fellas?
Everything.
Jimmy Fallon shows up once in Band of Brothers, in the final moments of Episode 5, Crossroads.
The crowd's had tigers, panthers, SPs, Stukas, Artie, and infantry just kept on coming.
He arrives in a jeep and delivers some ammunition to a group of weary soldiers who really need it.
What's your name, Lieutenant?
George Rice, 10th Armor.
Good work, son.
I'll try to make another ammo run if I can, but don't count on anything.
Lieutenant George C. Rice would be an otherwise unremarkable role, except it's Jimmy Fallon. At the time, he would have already been recognizable as a cast member on Saturday Night Live. So many viewers saw his appearance not as a bit part, but a celebrity cameo. The series came in for some light criticism that it was kind of distracting to see a famous face pop up so briefly in the middle of a show cast with mostly then-unknown actors.
Panzer Division is about to cut the road south. Looks like you guys are going to be surrounded.
We're paratroopers, Lieutenant. We're supposed to be surrounded.
Good luck.
Thanks.
So we've got two characters, Lieutenant Rice and Private Zelinsky. Both show up in the same episode. They have one scene each, just a few lines of dialogue. But one of them is highly memorable because of its high-profile casting. And the other needed a serialized podcast to remind audiences of who he was.
Backstage, either before or after, you pulled me aside and said, "Hey, I got to tell you this story about this time I auditioned for Band of Brothers."
This is Alan Sepinwall, Rolling Stone magazine's chief TV critic. He's talking about when he was the guest monologist at a UCB show I was part of back in 2019.
I said, "All right, well, what role were you supposed to be playing?" And you said Private Zelinsky. I had no memory of Zelinsky whatsoever, but you told me the whole thing, and then you told me about the idea for the podcast, and it sounded great.
Even before meeting him, I'd been a big fan of Alan's writing. He's written extensively about Band of Brothers. Cites the series as one of his touchstones.
It definitely is, and if there were so many actors in that show, so if any of them turn up anywhere else, I will shamelessly invoke Band of Brothers at some point. If a show uses like sort of a desaturated color filter, I will mention Band of Brothers. If it starts out in sort of a too chaotic a fashion, and then a few episodes in, they start doing character POV episodes, I'll say, "Oh, they're stealing from Band of Brothers." So I tend to see a lot of things through the lens of that particular miniseries.
I honestly don't think it's a weird thing for someone like Alan to have to be reminded of who Private Zelinsky was. The character was cast perfectly and performed unobtrusively by the actor that got the role after me, Adam Sims. On the other hand, Alan does not need to be reminded of when Jimmy Fallon shows up later on.
In your episode, or not your episode, but yeah.
I wouldn't claim it's my episode in the sense that I own it, but the one episode that I have the faintest connection to is episode 5, Crossroads.
Yeah.
And it always felt strange to me because, like, David Schwimmer's in the pilot, but he has a substantial role in the pilot. It's a real part.
Yes.
That's what the episode is about. And then it ties back in at the end. You see him in again at the end. It's meaningful. It's not a distracting. Some people might have been distracted by it, but it has a purpose.
Whereas Fallon just rolls up to provide these guys ammo in what's otherwise supposed to be a really scary and disturbing scene where they're seeing all of these troops marching away from Bastogne, looking shell-shocked, basically saying, like, being the ghost of Christmas future and warning them, like, "You don't want to go where we've just been." And there's Jimmy Fallon providing them the only hope that they have of surviving it. And so at the time, it was really distracting. When I went back and rewatched the series again, it didn't bother me as much, I think, because I'd gotten a little more used to Fallon away from Saturday Night Live. Or maybe I was just used to the fact that he was already there. But I think in hindsight, it was not the best casting choice.
In 2019, CNN did an interview with Band of Brothers LA-based casting director Meg Lieberman. She was pretty frank in admitting that she had no part in casting Jimmy Fallon. In fact, when asked about it, she laughed and said, "That was, in my mind, ridiculous, and I was opposed." I have to admit that, at the time, it sort of stung a little to see an already successful person show up in the same episode that I had been fired from. It just made me hyper aware that, for me, losing this role was a big deal. But for Fallon, it was something he filmed while he was on break between seasons of SNL.
His role on the show actually feels closer to what he does on The Tonight Show, in the sense that he kind of rolls up and he's like, "Hey guys, I got all this ammo.
Make a hole. I got ammo. Grab what you can."
Like a crowd-pleasing host.
Yeah.
I think if someone watched it now, they'd think, "Oh, it must have been because he's the host of The Tonight Show that he got this."
Yeah.
Like, I think someone who didn't know the timeline would feel like they were almost making a reference with it.
It is. It's distracting. It's very odd. And but like you say, it's also, it feels a little bit like he's setting, you know, Guarnir up to play a round of beer pong or something, or one of the other games he does on the show.
I wonder if everyone else sort of leveling up fame-wise balances it out, because at the time it would have been, here's a Saturday Night Live cast member and a bunch of unknowns who we believe are really in World War II, that it feels like there's an element of anachronism or time travel. And now you're having to do the adjustment on more than just him. You're sort of having to be like, I believe that this is a character. While also you have a screen history, yes, for many more people now.
I think that's right. But I also think that, like, everybody else who is now more well-known than they were at the time, they're disappearing back into 1940s. Like, they're doing, you know, other than Frank John Hughes, not a lot of them are doing the rat-a-tat, you know, hey, I'm the guy from Brooklyn, you know, who you might have seen in Stalag 17 or something.
Yeah.
But they feel like they're from the period, even though they're more famous. Jimmy Fallon's just Jimmy Fallon. That's always going to be an issue, no matter how much the other people are able to level up to his celebrity or even beyond it.
I was watching Jimmy Fallon's scene and thinking, well, if I didn't know who he was, there's nothing wrong with the performance. I don't think there's anything where I would be like, oh, that's a bad actor who's just come into the scene. You know, I don't think you'd even necessarily notice or remember the character.
Exactly, exactly. But would the guy in the Jeep, if it was anybody else, would he even have that much dialogue? I feel like he would show up, say, I've got ammo, and then the whole rest of the scene would be the guys grabbing the gear and marching on to Bastogne.
Obviously, I would like to talk to Jimmy Fallon about this, but so far, he's very busy. He does a show every day. It's one of those things where it's when someone's doing 5 hours of television every week, it's hard to find a time that they're going to carve out for podcasts. There's also a part of me that thinks, like, I read an interview in, I think, Parade magazine from a couple of years ago where someone else talked to Jimmy Fallon about being in the episode. And I kind of felt like most of those answers are probably the things that I would get if I was talking to him. He'd be like, yeah, it was weird. And, you know,
yeah,
it was really cool to be on the episode. You know, but, you know, I felt weird being on the Jeep. It felt weird when I was giving out the ammo, you know.
That's a good Fallon.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't do a lot of impressions, and that isn't really a calculated impression, but I do feel like once you start saying certain kinds of things, I think it's fairly easy to shift into a basic generic, like, no, it was great. We were, you know, we were pretending we were in World War II, you know. I've spent just about a year trying to get Jimmy on this show, going through official channels, Twitter, and at one point even heard back from a PR firm that wanted to know what exactly I was doing. I know people who have worked either for or with him, but everyone I talked to gave me some variation on the same answer. He's a busy guy and would probably not be into it. So, no Jimmy, for now. But I gotta say, sometimes the rabbit holes I fall into lead to more surprising stories than just bizarre Band of Brothers casting decisions. In this case, it led me to Alex. Yes, I knew she was hired and subsequently let go from The Tonight Show, but I didn't know the specifics of what it was like to apply for a job like that, or what it was like to lose it.
But you worked for, what's the term, two cycles?
Two cycles, yeah. So, well, they make you sign a contract that, like, you're committing however number of years, but they decide to renew you every 13 weeks.
Oh,
so that's
beautiful, isn't it? Where it's like, we want you to commit for years, but we can cut this off whenever we want.
Yeah, you know, that's fair.
Because they don't want you to, you know, be great and then decide to leave. If you're great, they want to hold you there.
Right.
And if you're not, then they want to get rid of you.
I do want to say, I feel like a lot of people share my experience of credentials and then the sudden stop of it from that specific show.
Let's start in the happier part of this experience. You put together a packet, right, to apply for the Tonight Show?
Yes.
What was in that packet?
So at the time, it was when you were submitting, you submitted both monologue jokes and, like, sketch materials. So they have, like, sketch writers and monologue writers, and it's a separate team.
Mm-hmm.
But I submitted 3 pages of monologue jokes, and it said to submit, like, however much existing sketch material you had. So I cut together, like, a 10-minute video of sketches I had written and had filmed and submitted, like, just included the link to that. And then I think the feedback I heard from the person who was like doing the hiring seemed like he had not read the monologue jokes at all. So I'm not sure that there was a point to that part, but he did like the video.
Do you remember any of the monologue jokes that you wrote? That's a terribly unfair question.
I don't, but I could look some up.
Tell me one if you think there's one that you're either really proud of or really ashamed of.
All right. Tonight Show Packet. Okay. Well, I won't look for the best one. I'll just read you the first one.
Yeah, just take a shot.
Maybe at the time I thought was the best
one. You led with it, so you must have felt something towards this joke.
Okay. The immigration minister for Canada, John McCallum, said that Canada will let 300,000 immigrants enter the country in 2017. And this part is the joke part I wrote. And if Trump wins, McCallum estimates they will hit that target by January 21st.
It's a dark joke.
This packet was written on October 31st, 2016.
Wow. So you wrote it before it had been finalized that everything was ruined?
It was a week before the election that I wrote it, and I got hired after the election.
So that must have felt like a nice balancing to how bad things were. Like, it's nice to get some good news right after bad news.
I guess so. I don't know if I equated the two.
Had it always been a goal of yours to write in a late night show?
Like, not really. I think once I started UCB, it became a goal to write on something.
Just something funny and good.
Yeah. And I guess the trajectory was like if you lived in New York.
Yeah.
Most of the writing jobs were late night shows. I do remember after I got The Tonight Show and I called my mom, she was very excited. And I think she started telling people that I was going to write for Saturday Tonight Live. So I don't think The Tonight Show meant anything specific for her.
You know what's great about that title is it's up for grabs. Like,
Saturday
we could start a show called Saturday Tonight Live and no one could stop us.
Yeah.
And it's a great title for a show.
It has a ring to it.
So when you got the feedback from that guy who said, I like the video, what was the next phase after you got that?
It was interesting because I knew he was a supervising writer there, but we met in a, I guess, kind of informal way. I'd already heard feedback from my manager, like, within the week that I submitted the packet. Like, she was like, oh, I heard whisperings that they liked your packet there. And then I think a couple weeks later, I did a sketch cram at UCB.
Or just basically where you have, like, 24 hours or something to write a bunch of sketches and perform them.
9 a.m. or something as a writer, and the show is at midnight. So you write until, like, something like a 9-to-5 day, and then the actors come in at 6 p.m., and then they rehearse the sketches, and the show goes up at midnight. So that supervising writer was one of the writers or directors for that sketch cram, and I noticed he, like, made an effort to, like, talk to me a bunch that day. And then afterwards, after the show, we all went to McManus, and he, like, sat down and kind of just, like, chatted with me a bunch. And I was like, oh, that's interesting that he's, like, seems to be giving me, like, special attention or anything. A few days later, I got the call from my manager that I got the job, but there was no, like, formal interview.
Were you surprised when you got the job?
I think so. I'd had, like, a feeling something might happen just because of that, like, sketch cram interaction.
Right. But you were expecting maybe something else might happen, like you might have to go
maybe an interview or something.
So the first time that you went into 30 Rock after submitting the packet was, like, you were working there.
Yeah. I had actually only recently interned there for SNL. Like, so I interned in 2015 in the set design department at SNL. So that was already, like, the like, very surreal experience of, like, getting to go to 30 Rock for work.
It's a very grand building, I would imagine, to work in.
Yeah, it's also very confusing. It's easy to get lost.
I used to love going there because I just wander around the basement stores of Rock Center. And I like
the
ice skating ring and stuff. But anytime I have to go there for either a one-day job or an audition or something like that, I find it very intimidating figuring out how to get up the elevators.
Right, because there's so many different elevator banks. And if you go up just like a random one, it won't lead you to where you need to go.
And I've had a lot of people in Rock Center get mad at me for doing it wrong.
Really?
Yeah.
Like the people you're there to see or like the security people?
I'm a stupid guy. They're just like, I'm trying to go through the wrong elevator and be like, no, you're doing the wrong one. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. And I'm just like one of 1,000 dumb people who have made the wrong mistake all day long, you know? Because they stand and they guard this entrance to the elevators, and all day long they have people who try to get through the elevator who aren't in the right spot.
Right. Well, maybe it's a design flaw for the building and not...
It's a crazy building.
Yeah.
I never feel like I belong in that building.
It's just a building.
No, it's not. It's different. It's different than other buildings, and it knows it. Like, it's a building that has an attitude towards everyone around it.
Yeah.
How long did you think you would be there?
I don't know. I thought about, like, in terms of signing whatever paperwork, I was like, I guess this could be years of my life. But I think as soon as I got there, maybe day one, but at least the first week, immediate fear that it would all be taken away.
Right.
And then just kind of like every week thereafter, just trying to like comfort myself of like, but that's okay. You make some money, you'll have this credit. You're not that happy anyway. It's okay. I'm just like talking myself through the possibility. I think because either the first day or the first week, there was already like anecdotes being told to us, the four new writers, of like the people who didn't get renewed or like, and they were friends of ours. So
were you replacing anyone?
A person we did know from UCB had worked pretty recently there and had only been there for like a cycle. And so like his story was the one that was like very much in my head of like...
Right. You took his place. It's possible, right? It's possible that that was the opening that allowed new writers to come in.
Also, I guess I'm hedging because it was a thing that was very much on my mind, but I don't think I've said it on a podcast, is that I was very aware that the two writers before me who had lasted the least amount of time were both the writers of color. And then the rest of this, the writing staff was mostly white.
Right.
Or if not, I think it might have been completely at the time.
Completely white. You were renewed for a second cycle.
Yes.
How long is the cycle?
13 weeks, which is 3 months.
Okay, so you were there for 6 months.
Yes.
What did it feel like when you got renewed for the second cycle? Did it change the way you thought about it in terms of, did it get your hopes up?
I remember it was like, it was a letter that came in the mail.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was like...
That's so much more formal than your hiring.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point. It was a letter that they had sent to... my manager's office that they had then sent in like certified mail back to me. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, you're renewed for, right, on like official NBC letterhead, I guess.
Did you keep the letter? Are you a person who holds on to things like that?
Oh, I hold on to everything.
Yeah.
Trying to throw away more things. So it exists somewhere, I bet.
How'd you feel when you got that letter?
I felt good. And then the three other writers who had started the same day as me also were renewed. So it was kind of like a sigh of relief, but then I guess a ticking clock again until the next.
Did you have a premonition, or was there a period where it started to feel like I'm not going to get renewed?
When it happened, it was a surprise because it happened earlier than I thought. Like the cycle is 13 weeks, and then the day they called me in to tell me I wasn't getting renewed was right after we had spent... a week in Orlando for the show, which was very fun. I had a good time.
Is that for the Jimmy Fallon roller coaster?
It's like one of those motion simulator
rides. Where you're not really moving, but the screen...
Yeah.
It's so like you're shaking like, you, right?
Yeah, kind of like that.
So you spent a week in Orlando.
Yeah.
Was that a fun week?
I had a really good time. And it was like one of the earlier times where I felt confident that Jimmy maybe knew my name now. Because we played Quiplash at one point in his office, like all the writers. And at one point, like Jimmy's like, I got you, Alex, or something. And I think I didn't understand what he said, and I kind of brushed it off. And from time to time, I still think about that moment as like, is that when he was like, we have to get rid of her?
Because you think he thought, I said her name and she
in
didn't.
In a supportive way, and she did not care.
That's an interesting thing to ponder.
It's almost has no legs or basis in real logic.
After the fact, it's very easy to go back and think about stuff like that. That, like, that day they were like, well, today's the day we're going to say Alex's name.
Yeah.
And I bet she'll get a real kick out of this.
Yeah.
And then he does it and you don't react to it. And thinks, well, she just sealed her fate. Now we're not going to renew her. I was expecting something in return. Does she know my name? Do you think he was like, Alex doesn't even know my name? She didn't say, thanks, Jimmy.
I hope that's what he thought.
When we return, I talk to Alex about her final day at The Tonight Show. Dead Eyes will be right back. I decided to rewatch the Tom Hanks movie Turner and Hooch on Disney Plus. I haven't seen it since it was originally released in theaters in 1989. It's a film where Tom Hanks plays a fussy, neat freak police detective named Scott Turner, finds himself living with a slobbering dog named Hooch, who turns his life upside down. The opening montage shows Scott Turner in his apartment, and within the first 4 minutes, we get a glimpse of his bed. And it occurred to me that in 2021, this guy, who is very smart and very particular about the way he lives his life, would probably order his mattress from Helix Sleep. They have a quiz you can take online. It's really quick, takes about 2 minutes, and they can tell you exactly which mattress is right for your body type and sleep preferences. Everybody is different, and Helix knows that, so they have several different kinds of mattresses to choose from. They have soft, medium, and firm mattresses, mattresses to cool you down if you sleep hot, and even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size folks. I took the Helix quiz, and I was matched with the Midnight Lux mattress because I wanted something that would accommodate tossing and turning and was neither too soft nor too firm. It feels great. I am confident that police detective Scott Turner would approve. And for what it's worth, I also think Hooch would like it. So if you're looking for a mattress, it's really simple. You take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store again. And you don't have to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired Magazine. Just go to helixsleep.com/deadeyes, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it. But you will. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. That's up to $200 off all mattress orders plus 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. What interferes with your happiness? Is something preventing you from achieving your goals? We talk a lot about disappointment on this podcast. How hard it is for all of us when we don't get what we want and things aren't going our way. In my own experience, I can't help but think that there were times when it might have been healthier if I had talked to somebody who was qualified to help me deal with my disappointment back when I was really feeling it. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp, which can connect you with a licensed professional therapist based on your specific personal needs. It's safe, it's convenient, it's online. You can start communicating in less than 24 hours. And it's not self-help, it's professional counseling. BetterHelp will make sure you find the therapist who's right for you. And they make it easy and free to change counselors if you need to, until you find the one you're happy with. It's more affordable than traditional offline in-person counseling, and financial aid is available. You can send a message to your counselor anytime, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without ever having to go to a physical office and sit in a waiting room. And because BetterHelp isn't limited by geography, there is a broad range of expertise available, a lot more than you might have access to wherever you're currently living. Licensed professional counselors who are specialized in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem. Anything you share is confidential, of course. You can check out the testimonials posted daily on their site. Start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/deadeyes. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DeadEyes.
For the non-renewal, you get invited into an office?
Okay, so setting like the time of year, it's April. We did the week in Orlando, then we had a week off, mm-hmm. like a hiatus week. And then we're back to work. This first week back goes by, and it's not until Thursday, which was a day that I had a bit on the show. It was just like a recurring, like I always produced the hashtag segment along with another writer. We would like, we were guaranteed FaceTime with Jimmy at least once a week because of this recurring bit mm-hmm. That we kind of inherited from other writers. So that Thursday, we had already gotten the jokes approved, and then I get a phone call to like my desk phone from one of the like showrunner's assistant that they wanted to meet with me after the show that night. And I think it was a double taping day too, so it was like we had like a 5 o'clock taping and then also an 8 o'clock taping.
To do a Thursday and a Friday show both on the same day?
I believe so, yeah.
Is that a normal thing?
At the time, it was like a special occasion, but I think they do that every single week now.
So on that Thursday, you did two shows and you were in one of them.
I had a bit in one of them, yeah.
But you're on camera in one of them?
No.
No, you're not? Okay.
No.
You wrote a bit. Were you ever on camera?
No, and... yeah, no.
Was there an extra element to that? Because sometimes writers will have bits on camera,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. No, it felt maybe at times political who
got on camera.
Who got on camera, yeah.
Right. So you did two shows and you knew you had a meeting after.
Yes. And as soon as I got that phone call of like, oh, can you meet with us after the second taping? My stomach just dropped, and like the co-writer for the bit, I like went to her and was just like, I think it's going to happen tonight. I don't think I'm getting renewed. And so she like pumped me back up and I like did my job for the rest of the day. I don't know. It was overall a fun day. Like I think any day you get a bit on, it's like
exciting.
Just exciting. Yeah.
So the second show ends
and I'm just like sitting in my office, which I shared with my friend who had also started the same day as me, and he almost always left after me, which, you know, that might be part of the problem is that I never really went above and beyond. But that was the one day he had like to go to drinks with his manager or something. So that was the one day he left before I did. And I was just like sitting in the room alone and just like so nervous. I finally get the phone call on my desk to like go over, and I do. And it's like two of the showrunners sitting with like a chair ready for me. And I forget if there was a little bit of a preamble of like, at one point they kept starting to say like, we really love you. But they were essentially like, it's not the right fit and we're not going to renew you. Mm-hmm. So anyways, they say this, I, unable to stop myself, am immediately just like tears falling down my face. But I am so startled by it that I start laughing. So I'm like just like smiling through just like tears streaming down my face. And they're saying like, you know, we're happy to write you a recommendation like anytime for anywhere. At one point, one of the showrunners does keep saying like, we love you. And I kept being like, does he want me to say I love you too? I don't know what to say right now. But I guess the timing was also surprising because there was a few weeks left of the 13-week cycle. And I did have the question of, like, there is work tomorrow. Am I supposed to come in? Am I supposed to finish out the cycle? And I think I must have asked that in some way. Like, do I still keep coming? And they were like, oh, well, you know, like, other writers have, like, taken that time to, like, start looking for their next job. But you will, like, be paid through the end of the cycle. So it was, like, it might have been, like, 4 full weeks before the end of the, like, 13-week cycle.
Wow.
So I still was paid.
Two-thirds of the way through your...
Through that. Yeah.
Did you come back?
No.
So you left and that you were gone that day.
Yeah. So I go back to my office. I think I close the like glass door for a little bit, cry a little bit. And then the other two writers who had started the same day as me, Colin Elsie and Joe Firestone, are still in their office next door. And I like go over and tell them what happened. And Joe comes over and just like, you know, gives me a really great pep talk. And then helps me clean through this giant stack of scripts I have on my desk. Because as we mentioned earlier, I don't ever throw anything away.
Right.
So I like kept every single script, like with my name on the cover of it. So if you have like a bit on the show, your name is on the cover of the script that day. So we went through the entire pile, got rid of most of it. I also had never really decorated my office. Always had the sense of impending doom, so it was pretty quick to like take down. Like I had like one little watercolor painting that I got from a Secret Santa gift. I took that off the wall. And then Joe like pushed me on the like rolly chair down the hallway, and that was very fun. It was like a ride to the copy room to recycle everything. And then Colin and Joe like took a car to Brooklyn with me, and we got a drink at Hot Bird, which also no longer exists in Brooklyn. And that was that day.
It's been years now since you were on Tonight Show. Do you think that you were a good fit when you were there?
No.
But is that, you're also very modest and self-deprecating. Sure. And like,
but I'm not exactly sure what, I don't know if I would say flat out I was not a good fit. I did agree, like when they were like, it's not, like I wasn't, like I didn't feel like my pitches were really going anywhere for like new bits and stuff. Occasionally it was frustrating because I would pitch something and it would get to the phase of like getting pitched to the celebrity guest and they would like it. But then through what felt like a random or process, they would just go with a different, like it wasn't the guest choosing, like someone else would just be like, eh, let's just do this other thing.
Right.
With them.
And it's your, like the fate of your material seems to be like, yeah, in a randomizer.
Randomizer, or just like, I didn't feel like there was anyone that was necessarily championing me that was like above me. And it, right, felt like that was maybe necessary in order to like go from pitch through the various stages of no's to finally like being on air. I don't necessarily think that I was the best fit, but I think more than anything, maybe I wasn't ready at the time. But I do think like having gone through that process, I like learned a lot, both about the pace of like a show like that, but also just, I think I learned about myself more than anything, of like how I behave in a writer's room. And that's like still a thing I'm working on.
Do you like the idea of being in a writer's room?
I think in any writer's room, like, I tend to just be the person who's, like, very comfortable riffing once the riffing has started. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't really contribute anything real to...
You don't start the riffing?
I don't start the riffing, and I don't necessarily start with, like, what about this idea? I know I'm able to make a room laugh.
Right.
So at least my voice was heard at some point, even though that riff doesn't necessarily contribute anything to the final product of the show.
Right.
So the most recent show I worked on, I like tried to be like, okay, if I like sense something that could be improved, I'm going to like point it out, but also propose a solution. So I think I listened to some podcast about like the different roles in a writer's room and was like, oh, there's a person who could be like giving possible solutions. So I tried to do that instead of just being the person who's like, this isn't working. Or I don't know if they highlighted the role of someone who just like does riffs in a room. But the sense I get is that that is not necessarily the most helpful person.
I think one thing that is really healthy about experiences like this is it doesn't sound like it was your dream job that you would have necessarily wanted to be there for a decade. You know, like it might have actually been more painful if you'd been there a year and a half or something.
And also timing wise, at least then, I like booked my first ever, and I guess at the time of recording, only a feature film role pretty shortly after, in a way that if I had stayed on for another cycle, I would not have been able to do it.
When I look at your talent compared to what I sometimes sense is like your confidence level, mm-hmm, being out of sync, in the sense of like, if I had your talent, I would be so confident all the time, you know? And I'm reasonably confident, you know, I'm not.
I think you are so talented, though. So do you have the same thing that you're rightly diagnosing in me?
I don't think I could put together a packet for The Tonight Show if my life depended on it. Like, just the act of putting together, like, write a bunch of monologue jokes. I'd be like, can I write jokes that sort of deconstruct the idea of a monologue joke? I think I could. There's things I could do. I don't think I could ever get hired by The Tonight Show.
Okay, well, okay. I do also want to say that, like, not across the board, but sometimes when you do something weirder that and is very you, like that's when they're like, oh, okay, now we're paying attention to this.
I still keep trying to find a way for you and I to have a show that is a real show, that is our job.
That would be amazing.
I think it should happen, and I always have ideas for it, but it's a matter of tricking someone with money into funding that show. Do you want to read a second monologue joke?
All right. I'm trying to think also.
When I first found out that Alex had been hired by The Tonight Show, I was happy for her, but honestly, I was happier for The Tonight Show. I thought, wow, what a great hire. It never even occurred to me that it wouldn't last, even though for Alex, it was something she thought about from the very start.
Okay, so this is a monologue joke that I wrote and I thought maybe Jimmy Fallon would say. Okay. Actor Idris Elba won his first professional kickboxing bout at York Hall the other day. Is there anything that man can't do? Said my wife.
That took a very personal turn.
I'm not exactly sure if that is a joke.
I'm not either. Is that alt comedy? I don't know.
I don't know if that's comedy.
I can't picture. I can't picture him saying that on the show.
Ever referencing his wife. So in that sense, no, I was not a good fit for The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon.
Of course, there are those people who might say that Jimmy Fallon wasn't a good fit for the role of George C. Rice in Band of Brothers. I'm not one of them. One, because I'd still like to have Jimmy on the podcast. And two, because I'm the last person who's going to say that any actor should or shouldn't have been replaced in episode 5 of Band of Brothers. So, sometimes, even when you get the gig on the prestigious and iconic television show, it turns out to be more like a detour in a long and varied career than a dream job. And yeah, people can argue and debate whether a particular actor is a distraction or not. Turn on the episode. Fast forward to those last few moments. There's Jimmy. He got the part, and he made the cut. He's in there, and it's forever. End of discussion. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests, Alex Songsha and Alan Sepinwall, who has a new podcast called Too Long, Didn't Watch, where he and a celebrity guest watch the first and last episodes of a long-running TV series. Also, thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use this song that's playing in the background. It's the title track from her 2012 album, Charmer. Fun fact, if you look up the official music video for this, it stars Laura Linney, who played Tom Hanks' wife in the motion picture, Sully. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email address is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks.
whose hosting of the recent Inauguration Day TV special Celebrate America saw him standing outside the Lincoln Memorial in fairly cold weather, introducing various segments like a pro. It was exactly what I, and I assume a lot of people, needed to see at the beginning of a new administration, after a very long 4 years, with a daunting journey still ahead of us. See you next time. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
That was a HeadGum Original.